While we're not talking about stealing, we are talking about generosity, sort of the other side of stealing. We are in part three of looking at this final core identity of joy and generosity and mission. This is how we start every year here at Jacob's Well, is we work back through these values, these core identities, these things that we understand to be the non-negotiable hows, the things we will not give an inch on in terms of how we live life together. And so we have been talking about this last one, these open hands over here of joy and generosity in mission. And a couple weeks ago, Pastor Manoj did a great job of getting us started with some principles about financial stewardship and how God views money. And then last week, we talked more specifically about what giving looks like, the heart that it comes from. So I just wanted to start with a really brief summary, that first slide there. We ended with these three truths from the scriptures. One, generosity is the freeing antidote to materialism. It's not just what we do with what we have left over. It is actually an active means to vote for Jesus' words that life does not consist in the abundance of our possessions. It is our declaration in action of that. And it's reworking our hearts. It's an active way to join with God in reworking our hearts to value Him above stuff, Him above money. Generosity is possible for and uniquely powerful from those in need. Generosity doesn't just start when we ourselves evaluate ourselves to have complete financial security, that God actually loves when we give out of from a place of our own need. And then finally, the generous will always have exactly what they need to do exactly what God wants them to do. This is one of the most powerful, audacious promises in the entire scriptures, taken particularly from Paul's long extended conversation about generosity in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, that he makes these extraordinary promises that if we have open hands, those hands will always be filled by God because he can entrust his resources to those hands to pass them along and do the work that he has purposed for those financial resources to do. And then we ended with this idea of the liberating freedom of just a little bit less is greater than, is better than, is more hopeful than, is truer than the enslaving lie of just a little bit more. If you missed that, would encourage you to go back and look at that that teaching from last week. But I wanted to build off that and today get a little bit more specific about giving, about generosity as a follower of Jesus. And so those conversations tend to start with a conversation around tithing. I remember many instances where people come into the church and then find out that there's this idea that you're supposed to give 10% away. And it can be a very jarring concept. It can be a wild thing. But I just wanted to show you some of the foundations of that biblically. And then what's interesting about the tithe is it's talked about a lot in the Old Testament, and then it's not mentioned in the New Testament, and it really leaves open the question, well, what is expected giving-wise of followers of Jesus? So I want to show you how we might wrap our brains around that issue. So here are the Old Testament foundations. Here are the Old Testament principles for understanding the tithe. I'm not going to go through every verse. There's actually a lot that we have to talk about this morning, so sorry for a bit of a fire hose approach to this, but the tithe, which literally means a tenth, one-tenth of something, was given as first fruits. Here's the idea. I have a field that tends that I expect to produce 100 oranges. The first 10 oranges that show up on the vine are my tithe to God. It's first fruits. It's the first fruit that comes in. So I'm anticipating 100 oranges. The first fruits, the first 10 that come in, I give back to God. This was meant as a means, like generosity in general, of reminding God's people that everything that they had ultimately belonged to Him. So is there a more powerful way to express that than giving the first of what they get to God? Notice that this is already a long way from our instinctual concept of generosity, which is, well, whatever's left over, I thought I was going to get 100 oranges. I ended up getting 103, so I guess those three can go elsewhere. That's how we normally think about it, right? But instead, what the tithe was meant to be was the opposite of that, was giving that first fruits to God as a declaration of our dependence on him, as a declaration that we understand that if the 10 have come in from him, the 90 will as well. It's an act of faith in God who is the provider. Second, it was given to very explicitly to support the priests in the nation of Israel. Back then, you have 12 tribes, 11 of whom were given plots of land to field and farm and to raise livestock and produce and all these kinds of things. But the priests, the 11th tribe, the tribe of anybody, Bible scholars? Oh, look at you guys. The tribe of the Levites were not given any of that land, but instead were told to tend to the temple, to the religious activities of the people. And so the tithe from the rest of these tribes was, at least in part, meant to support the work of these, what we would think of as sort of vocational ministers, the people whose vocation, whose job it was to minister in the temple. Third, it was given in joyful gratitude to God. One of the most interesting things about the tithe is that when the tithe was brought in, it was actually meant to be a time of celebration for the people, that the people were actually called to themselves enjoy part of what they were giving. It wasn't all just giving away. It was, you got a couple slices of oranges too. Like, this was meant to be a joyful celebration. This wasn't something that the people would bring their first tenth with heads bowed to the temple and say, oh, I hope the other 90 come. No, this was actually, right, it's at the beginning of harvest time. It's at the beginning of what they expected to come in. They would bring it joyfully and celebrate the giving of the tithe together. And then finally, specifically every 3 years, if you look at Deuteronomy 14, that's mentioned there. Every 3 years, almost the entire tithe was meant to be set aside for those who were in need in their midst, for the poor. And so most of the time, it primarily went to meet the needs of the Levites, but every 3 years, it was set aside specifically for the needs of the poor in their midst. Very compelling stuff. This absolutely sort of set the people of God's sort of general approach to money was one of generosity, was one of giving away. This was just kind of how they did life together. And it really does beg the question, it would be really nice, I'll be honest with you, it'd be really nice if Paul at some point just thought in one of his letters to be like, oh yeah, and that's right, by the way, you guys should tithe. That would be a really great thing for me, for those of us responsible for the finances of the church, to be like, and that's what it says, and therefore thou shalt. The New Testament often, though, takes a different approach to these types of areas. So I wanted to show you, go to the next slide, Gwen. I wanted to show you that these principles, by and large, still hold in the New Testament. So generosity is still very much a response to God's goodness. That doesn't go away. Paul, in that long discussion, most of these coming from that long discussion of Paul in 2 Corinthians 8, and 9, it's very much still meant to be a declaration of our dependence on God and understanding that all things come from God. Paul is very clear. This is in a little bit of a different place. This is where Paul famously says, at least among my ilk, famously says, don't muzzle the ox while it's treading out the grain. He uses this sort of Old Testament proverb to talk about, hey, the needs of people who are in vocational ministry should be met by those who they're actually ministering to. And so there is still absolutely this concept that there are those who receive their living, like myself, from vocational ministry through the giving of others. Certainly, Paul literally quotes the Old Testament when he says, it's actually not original to Paul, when he says, because God loves a cheerful giver. If you've been around church, been around the Bible, you've probably heard someone quote that. That's actually an Old Testament concept that Paul is quoting. And so still, the way that I wrote it, God still very much loves a cheerful giver. That's the attitude that we're to have. And then finally, absolutely generosity leads to provision for all. This is Paul's whole concept that he goes to again and again throughout that passage, that he's saying, I don't want any of you to end up yourselves impoverished on behalf of someone else. All I am calling for is fairness. It's this beautiful Greek word, isotes, that literally means that there would be a sense that in our midst, there is just not this, right? Like what we have in our world, profound income inequality that just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Paul says we should do things differently in here. There should be a sense that there are sufficient resources in the vast majority of local church communities, especially one like ours, such that there should be fairness among us, is what Paul is arguing for. And yet, in no particular place does Paul say, therefore, if you make this much amount of money, you should give this much. Therefore, let's all make sure we're tithing. And so it really does beg the question, well, where does that leave us in terms of what the New Testament expects of us? And I think the question that we should ask is, does the New Testament tend to expect more of God's people now or less of God's people now? Right? Like, we are on the other side of the death and resurrection of Jesus. We have the Spirit of God transforming us. We have seen that our ultimate needs will be utterly taken care of for all of eternity by the substitutionary sacrificial death of Jesus Christ on the cross. What we actually need most has been provided. And therefore, do you think that the New Testament would expect us to have more closed hands than God's people in the Old Testament or more open hands, right? I'm asking a rhetorical question. I think that the reason why Paul doesn't prescribe to us anything is because, and you've probably heard me say this before, this is the biblical backing for why this is kind of what we often say, is that I think a tithe is a good place to start thinking about how much you should give. For some of us, it is far too little. And I don't think the New Testament would back away from declaring that. That as, right, we talked about this last week, that as some of our standard, as our income increases, we automatically go to, well, my standard of living can increase, whereas the New Testament would say, but if there's fairness, maybe it's your standard of giving that increases as your income increases. I think that that's more the expectation. I also, though, think that the New Testament very much doesn't prescribe this because it also says, Jesus himself says, the poor you should always have among you. There should be those with profound needs who don't feel shamed by the wealth of others. And therefore, for some of us, the tithe is just too much at certain seasons. And these things can change. I think the New Testament, with the Spirit of God dwelling in each follower of Jesus individually, leaves it to our own discernment before God to have that honest conversation with him, with trusted community, with those who maybe we manage our finances with. And as we talked about last week, I think where often our generosity falls short is we just never have that conversation, right? Because of maybe our own sin and idolatry in this area, maybe because of our own shame, maybe because just no one has ever gotten up, stood in front of you and said, this is something you should probably think about. And it just so happens that where the Lord has us this morning, I am saying to you, this is something worth thinking about. Now, here's what I'm somewhat aware of. We don't, you know, we're not weirdos. We don't check your giving every week in and week out. But we do look at the finances of the church. You should be glad about that, right? Like, we do look at, and I know that I'm standing in front of, compared to most studies that come out about the American church and American Christians, I know I'm standing in front of an exceptionally generous church, okay? But one, that does not mean that there's not more that we can be doing. And two, that doesn't completely cover your own individual conversation with the Lord about whether you should be giving. It does, though, mean that there is a place, even in a sermon like this, to say, hey, well done. Well done to so, so many of you. Well done to those who, many of you are giving out of your poverty, like the Macedonian churches that we looked at last week. Well done to you, right? You don't need to feel some weight of guilt on a Sunday like this. You can feel the Lord's pleasure over you, right? Whereas some of you, I hope, would take maybe the little bit of conviction you're feeling right now and actually interrogate that and bring that to the Lord and say, Lord, do you want me, right? Not do you want me to do a little bit more, but remembering everything we talked about last week, Lord, do you want to loosen my hands a little bit more? Do you want me to be a little bit more free in this area? Just getting real practical, this also is from the work of Randy Alcorn, who many of you followed up to ask where to start with him, and I'm really glad about that. He has a little tiny book called Treasure Principle. It's a great place to start. He says, give generously. regularly, sacrificially. Those are really good starting points. Give generously, regularly, sacrificially. This is where, honestly, this is where automatic stuff, right? Automatic payments coming out, which many of you do, even for our church, is really helpful. I think I might be a little less generous if I actually had to write a check every week. I'll just be totally honest about that, right? There's something nice about that regularity that can be built into how our finances are stewarded. We give sacrificially, we give generously. Give proportionally and increasingly, right? That's this whole idea of if your income increases, don't think first of your standard of living, think of your standard of giving. Three, I am the lead pastor of this church, and I'm saying this, and I know that that might come off some kind of way, but the scriptures are crystal clear that there is an expectation that your primary giving, I think, would be to the local church. Now, there's absolutely exceptions to that. But what I can tell you, right, is that our church has also modeled corporate generosity from jump, which means that, I don't know how many times you've heard this, but 20% of what comes into our church immediately goes out to other partners. So if you give $100 to this church, 20 of that is being distributed to all kinds of other things going on, or literally going on around the world. We've tried to model that generosity. That's, I think, what the local church is meant to be. It's not just building up our stuff so that we can have a laser light show and cooler smoke machines and, you know, like, I can drive a nicer car or whatever it is, right? Like, so that we can corporately then be more generous. And I can tell you that as best as I can, with as much integrity as I can, is that we take that really seriously here. Also, above and beyond the local church, give to things that connect with you. And this, I use pretty general language because I think it's like, give to things that relationally you're connected to, right? Like if someone has a meeting with you, I speak on behalf of the many parachurch people here who are fundraisers, right? If somebody asks for a meeting with you, I would lean towards saying, go into that meeting and say, I'm probably going to say yes to this because this is someone that I'm relationally connected to, right? Or give to things that really speak to your heart. Right? Like that's one of the reasons why we try and give you exposure to our own partners here. Is maybe you hear one of these and you go, man, that's so cool that Santa and Amanda are in Italy. I have such a heart for Italy. I have family in Italy. I'm going to start giving to them because that really connects with my heart. I think that the Lord can use those kinds of things to sort of determine where your giving goes. And remember, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. You will find yourself even more drawn to those things. That's good and right and wonderful for you to consider. All right? Remember, God's trying to open our hands a little bit more. There's an invitation here, not just a yoke of burden. Which, speaking of, I want to take a little bit of a hard left turn, but it's deeply... it's deeply relevant to everything that we've been talking about because, especially on a Sunday like this, right? Like you can hear a pin drop in here because these can be heavy things, right? And we can wear these in a certain kind of way. And I've been thinking about where Jesus says, I think he's talking to the lawyers, whatever he means by that. He says, "Woe to you, lawyers, because you heap up burdens on others, and yet you yourself don't lift a finger. You yourself won't touch those burdens and be helpful to those burdens yourself," right? And insofar as a Sunday like this might feel burdensome to you, I want to let you know that we, as your leaders, we want to do some of that lifting with and for you. And so we've been thinking a lot about what that looks like. And one of the things that we have come up against, and this is mostly through Mercy Ministries, the work that Tim and Patty do, one of the things that we have seen again and again and again is that many of you are suffering under the yoke of tremendous debt. Of like high interest, particularly credit card debt, maybe a car loan that you can't get out from under. And it's something that has happened so frequently that we began having discussions, and this is a real passion of Tim's for years and years, but we began to have discussions, I don't know, maybe 6 months, a year ago now, about what it would look like to actually move towards this. Because one of the realities that's behind that debt is an economic system that we believe has injustices inherent to it. And we really think that one of the ways that we can embody this core identity of seeking justice and mercy is doing things differently in here versus out there. And so we began to have conversations around what would that look like for us to do things differently in here. And so I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that and then talk about something that we'll be rolling out over the next number of months in order to help with this. But first, I want to, this is going to feel very different than what we normally do here. But first, I just want you to understand why this is such a pervasive issue. And one of the reasons why it's such a pervasive issue is I think because many of us just don't understand the concept that's behind how you end up in this place. And how our economic system feeds off of our lack of awareness of how this works. So Einstein, like that Einstein, we think he said this. It seems like maybe it's apocryphal, but I think it's more powerful if Einstein said it. So Einstein said something like, or someone like Einstein said something like, compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. He who understands it earns it. He who doesn't pays it. Whoa, that's the biggest response I've ever gotten in this pulpit. Come on, guys. Sheepers. Okay, compound interest, he said something like compound interest is the most powerful force in the universe. Okay, so one example of this. Here's a positive example. Here's why you should save. And students, here's why you should save super early in life. Go to that next slide. Here's a little graph that I put together. You start at $0. At some point, you start putting $100 away into an account that returns about 7%. That's like a decent, you know, whatever, 401k, that kind of thing. And you do this for 40 years. At the end of 40 years, if you do the math, you will have put into that account yourself $48,000. But the account, because of how that interest works, will end up with a final balance of $262,000+. Okay? The eighth wonder of the world, y'all. Right? Like, that is an extraordinary thing. This, there's all sorts of versions of this where, like, if you were to start instead 10 years later, that number goes down precipitously. That number ends up being like $150,000. So the earlier you choose to do this and the more consistently you choose to do this, the better off you are. Now, those who understand that earn it. Those who don't, right? And I'm not saying, by the way, don't hear me saying this, that the only reason why credit card debt exists in your life is because I'm not trying to like patronize you. Like some of you understand this full well. You're like, cool, but I went through, you know, medical emergency or I had expenses that I couldn't get out from. I'm not saying that this is the only reason. I just want you to understand this because I remember someone telling me this to me. I was way older than most of, you know, these students when I finally began to understand this. Okay, here's it done negatively. Those who don't understand that pay it. Here's how credit cards work. Next slide. Okay, so you put $5,000 on a credit card for some expense, right? Credit card rate, that's actually a pretty good rate. I'd love for you to find 20%. Your minimum payment is 2% of whatever the balance is. And then this, right? Like you think of the minimum monthly payment as, this is not what that means, okay? This might be the most important thing here today. What a minimum payment on a credit card is not, if you pay this amount, you won't be charged interest on your balance. Okay, that's not what it means. It's definitely what I thought it meant for like the first 10 years of having a credit card. It's not what it means. All that it means is you won't be charged another fee on top of all of this. So if you were to do this, right, put $5,000, only pay a $100 payment every month, it would take you over 30 years to pay that off. And you would end up paying $22,000 on a $5,000 balance, okay? That is a lot, right? And these numbers, there's all kinds of calculators like this online that will show you just how quickly this thing jumps into the stratosphere. All right, let's go back to scriptures and see if you have as strong a response. Exodus 22. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a money lender to them, and you shall not exact interest from him. About yay. Maybe just like a You shall not charge interest on loans to your brother. Interest on money, interest on food, interest on anything that is lent for interest. You may charge a foreigner interest, but you may not charge your brother interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you undertake in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Okay. How does God feel about this? He doesn't love this. Okay? This is unjust. We're about to go through, by the way, many people have asked. We'll start in a longish series in Proverbs next week. We've never gone through Proverbs as a church, except a very short series. All over Proverbs, this is talked about, and that this is not something that the Lord looks at favorably. Now, if you notice, there's two caveats in this, right? In the first one, it's don't lend money and charge interest to those who are poor. So what about those who aren't poor? Can I lend interest to them? And then the second one, there's don't lend interest to a brother, but you can lend interest to a foreigner. Sweet, right? If you think I'm joking, this is what God's people in the Old Testament and God's people fairly recently tried to use to get out of it. All right, here's the New Testament. Womp, womp. Here's the voice of Jesus, okay? If you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. We're talking about loving. We're talking about like Jesus' biggest category. Where does he go? And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good, and lend expecting nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you'll be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful even as your Father is merciful. Fascinating study. Tim Dees put this book in my hand a year ago. It is like this tattered, out-of-print book. It feels like, it felt like, who's the king in the Old Testament who finds the law? And they're like, oh no. That's how it felt to me, as I was like, oh my goodness. And it's called usury is what we're talking about. Which is a word that I feel like has dominated my mind for 6 months. Usury is the charging of excess interest. It's literally called usury. And just the title itself is powerful. It says, from tribal brotherhood to universal otherhood. From tribal brotherhood to universal otherhood. Here's the simple version of that story. I'd encourage you, if you're interested in it, to go chase it down. All I could do was make this very simple timeline. From the time of Jesus' resurrection, next slide, to the Reformation, about 1,500 years later, the church universally, spoke out, absolutely forbid the giving of interest on loans. In fact, in like 1315 or something like that, you have a papal like declaration that anyone who is charging interest on loans should be excommunicated. I mean, that's how strong it is. Then you have, look, it's a very complicated story. Then you have the market economy, you have the giving of loans, you have the Medici, so you have all of this stuff that begins to come around, and it really pushes the church to reconsider its stance on this, because, oh, we're realizing that the giving of loans, the giving of interest is a means of actually beginning to build, financial. And so it's really, it's the first, it's one of our most beloved in a tradition like ours. It's John Calvin who begins to give ground on this. And he begins to go, well, maybe, in the Old Testament it says it's okay. And it's fairly complicated, and scholars disagree, right? Like, it does seem like there's a difference between how we do things in here and how we do things out there, and is this like we should just speak against this? I can tell you this much, guys. The predatory nature of lending is something that we can confidently say that the Lord is not about that. In terms of, okay, is there an argument that sometimes the giving of loans creates wealth in a way that then will create even more wealth down the line for both parties involved and all that? I am not smart enough to understand all of that or to break that all down or to have that argument with you. What I can tell you is what the New Testament says. That's what I study. What the New Testament says, what church history says here is really interesting, where for 1,500 years it's like a non-negotiable, and we have just gone, well, whatever. The name of this book is From Tribal Brotherhood to Universal Otherhood, because what the church ended up doing is it ended up saying, well, I can lend and charge interest to anyone because we are distinct economic entities from each other. Whether you're a Christian or not, you are an other from me, and therefore it's the other stuff, it's these provisions in the Old Testament that give me enough room to breathe to treat you like a foreigner, basically. And money goes from something that was largely seen as the church as a means. I really like this term, and sorry that it's a big one, but it goes from being a means of social cohesion to a means of othering each other. And I do think that this is where our current economic moment and market economy and all that stuff that again, I'm not smart enough to understand everything, but I do see and observe this. That the privatization, that money being something that you don't get to speak to into my life, that I get to choose how I want to use, I do think is a capitulation to the world in a way that we as the church need to move against. If we are to do things differently in here than they're done out there, this feels like one where we can be really distinct and different, where we can actually choose brotherhood with each other. So here's what we're going to do. We're starting something called the Jubilee Initiative. Jubilee is this beautiful concept, comes from the Old Testament, Leviticus 25 specifically, where every 50 years in Israel, they were called to forgive any debts that existed in their midst. Land was returned to its original owners, and enslaved Israelites were set free. Fascinatingly, we have no record that this ever happened. but what scholars do say is that Jubilee was absolutely, it set the terms of how God's people understood their economic relationships and responsibility to one another. It was meant to prevent economic oppression, to reset social inequalities, and remind Israel that everything ultimately belonged to God. So that's why we're naming this the Jubilee Initiative. What is it? What it will be are these things. It will be a permanent fund, kind of like the Emergency Relief Fund, the relief fund that Mercy Ministries oversees. This will be a permanent fund overseen by Mercy Ministries. That will also involve a team of mentors, a team that we're putting together as we speak, who will provide input to folks in this area. And so it's kind of both of those things. It's a team of mentors and then this permanent fund. What it will provide are debt relief grants. We're using that very specifically. We're not trying to become a loan organization or something. But these grants will have suggested repayment plans to them so that there is a sense of paying it forward. There will, of course, be zero interest in that way, with the idea that, right, we will do an initial capital raise for this and then provide debt relief to folks. And then to the extent that it's paid back, we get to keep doing that moving forward. That's the idea. Along with that relief, we'll provide mentorship. And so basic discipleship around these things, but also like really practical stuff like help with budgeting, accountability. Each case will be kind of considered case by case. What mix of all of those things makes the most sense for you? Again, overseen by Mercy Ministries. We don't, to be totally honest with you, we don't have ton of proof of concept. It's not like, oh, and the six other churches doing this in our area have given us great input. We're aware that there's churches who do medical debt relief and stuff like that, but we haven't really found one that's doing this, so this is new ground for us. We feel like it's just crazy enough that it fits us. breaking barriers to encounter Jesus together, right? That's our vision, man. And if this is a barrier that we keep coming up again and again and again to people encountering freedom in Jesus, we just got to the point as your leadership where we said, we got to do something. We have to do something about this. And so shout out to Patty and Tim, who have done a lot of the background stuff on this. What we need this morning is we need a sense of the need that exists in the community, because we're not designing this for just anyone. This is for folks who call Jacob's Well home. And so we're very much okay with designing the program around the needs that exist. Right, Tim? Is that the best way to say that? And so here's what we're going to do. Don't put it up yet, but I'm about to put up a QR code that'll take you to a simple form that gives you three things that you can check off, and we're asking you to check off any that apply to you. The first is if you need debt relief, and we will ask you at least for an initial number so that we start to get a sense. If you're a member here and you're at the last members meeting, we did a version of this before. Now we're trying to get even more sort of solid on what we're looking at here. So that'll be your first option. Do you need debt relief? How much are we talking about? The second one, the second option will be, do you need like basic financial instruction? Right, no one's ever sat with you and done a budget. You don't understand saving. The compound interest stuff maybe to you is like, whoa, that's very overwhelming. You just need basic sort of financial input. We'd love to provide that. We've been doing that for years and years and years here. That's not some new thing. That's always on offer. The third one is if you'd like discipleship, like more like specific discipleship and accountability in this area. This one might apply to you even if you don't check either of the first two. Maybe you have plenty of you know, maybe you don't have financial need. Maybe you understand finances, but man, this is a real area of struggle. And maybe the last couple weeks have led to a lot of reconsideration for you. Maybe it's that, right, that standard of giving versus standard of living stuff. And you're just like, yeah, I'm just not there. Or maybe it's the stuff we talked about with spending. You're just like, man, this is a real area of struggle. Or it's generosity. And man, I just find that my hands close around what I have. If you're willing to say, yes, that is where I'm at, we want to figure out how to serve you well and come alongside you and provide that kind of discipleship. We're a discipleship-heavy church, and we feel like this is a great opportunity for you to have the opportunity to just name, yeah, this is an area of real struggle for me. All right, let's put this QR code up. I would ask you, even if you're not going to check this off, go ahead and take the QR code. Just so you haven't, just so that the people who put up their phone don't feel like, oh, am I the only one doing this? And I'm just going to give you 2 or 3 minutes to review that form, to check it off, and then I'll end us in just a minute. All right, a couple things. One, we wouldn't be designing this if we thought it was relevant for two of you. We would just come to you and talk to you. we believe that this is widespread enough that there just shouldn't be shame. There shouldn't be shame. We're not doing this to shame. We were doing the exact opposite. And so please don't hesitate, because that's a barrier. That's a lie from the enemy, I can tell you. That, ooh, if they know it's you, ooh, and you're a leader here, or ooh, they know it's you, and you have this income, ooh, they're going to really judge you. Guys, we're trying to free people up, man. Like, that's our only intention in this. Like, default to talking to us. We really, really want to see God do a work here. So no shame. And then the other thing, sort of where this goes from here, is it might take a little bit, but our intention is to kind of follow up with folks, whoever fills this out, get a deeper sense of the need. Obviously, at some point, we'll do a fundraising for this, and we would love that to be like all of us contributing to this. We really don't want to rely on just a couple folks, and so please be thinking about that. Yeah, what could we give to that? Would be a really cool thing if we could just collectively meet that need. The Apostle Paul starts that whole discussion in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, and he says, guys, this is my modernization version of it. He says, guys, the coolest thing has happened. God's grace has been poured out in Macedonia. And it's just been extraordinary. You should see it. You should see what's happened. And if you remember way back to last week, he's actually talking about those who gave. He's saying, man, the coolest thing happened is that in their extreme poverty, joy took over. And they were able to be generous, and generous enough that they're going to provide for you guys. And so all I'm trying to do, Paul is saying, is like complete the cycle of a work that God began that's going to lead to such freedom, to greater joy. And he literally says, and ultimately, to the glory of God. Right? That's our ultimate purpose here, is to give God glory. And we really believe that this little initiative has such potential for God to just be smiling. And to be blowing wind at our back and just going, man, you guys are nuts. What are you doing? But I love it, right? And to just receive that grace. This is all about pursuing Jesus more. I'll just end by bringing us to this table again, right? The Apostle Paul lands the call to generosity as saying, because you know the grace of God, that Jesus himself, though he was rich, infinitely wealthy, made himself poor so that out of his poverty, you might be rich in all the ways that matter. And so as we come this morning and consider either our own need or as we consider what it would look like for us to move more into generosity, let's come to a generous God who always goes first in generosity. And so how we do it here is we come down these two aisles. There's bread on the outside, it's a gluten-free option in the middle. The bread representing the body of Jesus broken for us so that we could go free. The